Hello, and welcome to the Aldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing our leading historian, Lady Antonia Fraser, a new columnist at the Aldie at the age of 92. And she's just brought out a terrific new book, Patchwork Pieces, coming out on October the 10th. Antonia, if you can just tell me what was behind the book.
I wanted, in some way, being around 90, as you said, I wanted to commemorate the richness of life. I just wanted to go here, I wanted to go here, I wanted to go there. I knew I couldn't any longer do huge biographies in 10 years, but I felt just as bright and brisk as ever. And the point about patchwork, which I've always liked, is that you sort of pull things to bits and make other things. And it's so colourful. And to me, leaving aside the horrors of life, which we all know about, the colourfulness of life is what makes it worth opening one eye in the morning and possibly opening the other too.
And we've had a few of these terrific patchwork pieces in the Aldie, and we've got one in the upcoming issue on Guy Fawkes, because obviously November the 5th is coming up. And were you slightly conflicted about the story of Guy Fawkes as a Catholic, you as a Catholic yourself? And you describe it in the book as, you could say, it was a terrible attempt at mass murder or a distinguished political move.
Yes, I think it's a very interesting subject, particularly if you're a Catholic. And I had a really good time doing it. I like working in Catholic archives, which are exactly like the Da Vinci Code, you know, they're dark and gloomy, and sort of arches come over your head. All of that I thought was very good fun. My parish church is Farm Street Jesuit Church. They've got a wonderful archival library. But the real point of the book is, did they do it or didn't they? And a very nice Catholic priest who was very helpful was absolutely convinced they were innocent. And I rapidly became convinced that they were guilty. The point of my book is why they did it. And I think that is the point of the Gunpowder Plot. Why did these nice, good, church-going people plan to blow up their leaders? And the answer is because they were treated in this appalling fashion. They were tortured. They weren't allowed to go to mass. They weren't allowed to do this. They weren't allowed to do that. And therefore, I think it's exposing what the Catholic fate was, which is important, as well as, of course, a sideline on whether they did it or not.
Right. And your book and your column in the Aldie is full of wonderful historical mysteries, and you seem to have cracked a delicious one, which is the story of Marie Antoinette and her initial inability to conceive, if we put it like that. Tell us about how you found out the result of that.
Harry, I have to say that's a slightly misogynist remark, which is not at all like you, because it wasn't Marie Antoinette, it was her husband, Louis XVI. He was unable to take the action which is essential to conceive.
My apologies, yes.
And poor Marie Antoinette, who was 14, and every night had to go to bed with courtiers looking at her and saying, "Now, dear, do it, you know." And, "Yes, but I can't, because he won't." And I had some very funny times researching, including going to a cricket match, because my late husband, Harold Pinter, was mad about cricket, and Sunday afternoon very often found me at a cricket match. On this occasion, it found me sitting next to a very nice doctor, and I said, "What is your speciality?" And he said, it's phimosis. I don't expect you to know what that is. I said, as a matter of fact, I do. I gave him a short lecture on phimosis because it was what was probably stopping Louis XVI from conceiving a child.
You may have to say to all the readers or listeners, or I'll do it if you prefer, what phimosis actually involves.
It's an infection which prevents the vital organ being operative.
Right, I think very good way of putting it, yeah.
Anyway, I had a very interesting time. I went and saw him in his official office and then became convinced it wasn't phimosis, it was psychological. And then I end my piece with my imagination, which is what Marie Antoinette said the morning he'd actually made it. And she swooned backwards and said, "Encore."
Brilliant. And you refer to your late husband, the great playwright, Harold Pinter, and the book is coming out on what would have been his 94th birthday, I believe. And he often, as you said, accompanied...
Not his 34th.
94th, it Sorry. Would have been, yes. Yeah. And he often accompanied you on your trips for what you call optical research. Can you explain optical research?
Well, optical research was a phrase which I invented for talking to my accountant, but it really means going to a place and looking at it, which I think is frightfully important with history. Of course, you can only look at a bit of it, but that makes it more exciting at what you do find. I mean, beginning with, for instance, Stirling Castle, where Mary Queen of Scots was born, and going right on to the various places which are key in our history. And I find great pleasure in going places and looking at them. I remember coming out of the House of Commons where I'd been listening to a debate and popping into Westminster Abbey, and which was bang next door, and suddenly realising that the tomb of Mary Queen of Scots was in Westminster Abbey. And I didn't rush. I sort of rushed. And I knelt and prayed. And I thought her motto about, you know, in my end is my beginning. I thought, in your end is my beginning. I went away and started the book.
Because it must be difficult when writing any history about determining what actually happened, and things like tombs and old buildings can remain the same. What do you do about the grey area in between? You don't try to imagine what people like Mary of Queen of Scots were actually thinking, do you?
I think that's for historical novelists. I mean, of course I do in a sense, but I don't announce this is what they said, because I think that I respect historical novelists, but I don't particularly enjoy reading them, even the great ones.
And you say in your new book that Harold quite often accompanied you on optical research trips, particularly if it happened to involve a cricket match.
He would drive along a battlefield, but suddenly discover a cricket match going on the battlefield. It was quite remarkable the amount of cricket matches he managed to find on battlefields.
And another wonderful vignette in your book goes all the way back to your first book, which I think this must be a world record, certainly a British record, that you wrote 70 years ago in 1954. Can you explain how that came about?
I was just left Oxford. I was 21, and I was working for George Weidenfeld, who was a wonderful man, a great publisher, then quite a junior publisher, and surviving by printing books for Marks and Spencer, which were out of copyright, so we could enjoy the profits without having to pay an author. And every few months he went and saw Marks and Spencer and came back with a list of books. And one day he came back and the list included King Arthur. And I said, very importantly, at last I could say something. I said, you can't do that, George, because it doesn't exist, and T.H. White is still in copyright. And George, without a pause, said, you, Antonia, will write it. So my first book was done to a command. And I'm glad to say it sold thousands of copies simply because it was in Marks and Spencer. And people still find it in Amnesty bookshops, you know.
But it was something you had always wanted to do from childhood, is that right? To write and to be a historian particularly?
I was a writer, that's what I told myself. And I liked writing history ever since I read... Do you ever read Our Island Story?
I did, yes, older than you were, because you read it when you were very young, didn't you?
Well, I learnt to read when I was very young. I was very lucky. My mother, I was the eldest child. My mother had nothing else to do. Very clever woman. Suddenly, her occupation is gone. And so she taught me to read. And my mother had many wonderful qualities, great writer, beautiful woman, a temper which could be tickled. And I was very frightened of annoying her, so I just learnt to read very quickly.
And I've asked you before about where the famous Pakenham literary gene comes from, and you suggested it started with you, is that correct?
I think I was teasing you.
Yes.
Since we're related, what yes. did you say on that occasion?
Well, I think I'd ask you because I am your cousin. My great aunt, your aunt Mary Clive, had written books. Your aunt Violet Pole had written books and was married to Anthony Pole, the great novelist. And your parents, Frank and Elizabeth Longford, both wrote books, but I think you said they wouldn't have defined themselves primarily as writers.
No, my mother, I think, and my father would have described themselves as politicians. And they were certainly politicians all my childhood. They stood between them three times for Parliament, four times for Parliament. I think writing... At the same time, books were everything, thank goodness. I lived in a house stuffed with books, unlike Harold, who lived in a house with no books. Very odd, the difference.
I also suggested, don't you agree with this, that your parents' generation, particularly your father and his siblings, because their father had been killed at Gallipoli, they grew up in large houses in Ireland and Oxfordshire with large libraries and also without a father, so there was, for all the tragedy of that, there was a certain sort of freedom, do you think?
Yes, I think they were free to be imaginative in many different ways. I think my father was a very eccentric, wonderful man because he'd not had a father figure to stop him.
And your brother, Thomas, who is also... extraordinarily enough, publishing a book this month as well, The Tree Hunters, on the men from Britain in the 19th and 18th century who went out across the world to bring back extraordinary seeds. He also suggested that gene, that writing gene, might have come even further back from your great-grandmother, Lady Jersey, who lionised writers. Would you agree with that?
I don't. No, if Thomas feels that, he's a frightfully good writer himself. I feel my gene was just hopping about in heaven on a cloud and saw me and thought that could be fun. So I think it's my own.
And you referred to Harold Pinter being brought up with no books. Where do you think his writing gene, if you want to call it that, came from?
I think he was just a genius, something that was acknowledged when he got the Nobel Prize. No books, no relations who wrote. I mean, exact opposite. I'm surrounded with writers. Three of my children are professional writers, for example.
And how did you, before his sad death, how did you live your writing lives together in this lovely house in Camden Hill Square where we're talking at today? Did you talk about what you were both writing? Did you write in different rooms? How did it work?
Oh, we only once in all our 33 years wrote in the same room when we went to a hotel in Eastbourne to get away, and there weren't two sort of study rooms, only one, so we had to write together. Harold wrote The Whole of Betrayal, his wonderful play. I wrote one paragraph of King Charles II.
Because you found it impossible to work in the same room, or because
I was peeking and seeing what he was doing, sort of more or less looking at his head.
But otherwise you worked in separate rooms in this house, is that right?
And he actually had a separate house attached to our house, a little house at the bottom of the garden. That was a very good idea, because it was quiet.
And would you discuss each other's works as you were writing?
Oh, yes. Harold had a frightfully good sense of language, because he loved language, and he'd point out I'd used a word like sanguine 45 times. It was very helpful.
And he was interested in history and was very knowledgeable about history?
No, not knowledgeable at all, as he would be the first to say, but was interested, so it was very good for me. He was obviously very intelligent, to have a very intelligent person. We didn't know. I remember once he said, when I was writing Marie Antoinette, who was Robespierre? And I said sharply, everyone knows who Robespierre was. And he said, well, I don't. And that taught me a lesson.
And to finish on your lovely new book, Patchwork Pieces, it has some terrific photos from the photo albums that sit next to us here as we talk, and some terrific pictures of friends, including Tom Stoppard and one Robert De Niro. They dropped in here, or you just came across them, and they've never been published before, is that right?
No, I mean, they're just from my albums. Tom was a great friend of ours, and I'm glad to say remains so. I can't claim that Robert De Niro is a great friend, but I met him. I was determined to have a photograph.
Anyway, it's a terrific photo, and it's an absolutely terrific book. So thanks so much to Antonia Fraser for her new book, Patchwork Pieces, out on October the 10th, and for appearing on the Oldie podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Harry.